If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code, a lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM. Let's create.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. This is Rob Lamb.
And this is Joe McCormick. And today's movie on Weird House is the 1976 Greek or Greek-ish horror film, The Devil's Men, also known as Land of the Minotaur. And I'm going to say right at the top, this is definitely not one of the best or most riveting films we have watched for Weird House Cinema, though I think it will still make for a fun episode. I almost feel like we were kind of tricked into it because there are a lot of names here that really want to invite you into the labyrinth. It stars Donald Pleasance and Peter Cushing. It's also got Luan Peters and a score by Brian Eno.
Mm-hmm. I think that was the kicker. That was the what really drew us in. We're like, oh, Brian Eno scored this film. Well, of course we want to take a closer look. As we'll discuss, this is exceedingly noteworthy. And ultimately, I think this is the factor that makes this such an interesting hidden gem. There are a few other production notes that I think make it stand out. Again, you mentioned it is a Greek or a Greek-ish horror film. It was a Greek-American co-production, essentially, and we'll get into some of those details. But yeah, it has two big stars. It has this fabulous score, and unfortunately, it doesn't necessarily have a lot else to recommend it, but it's still going to be fun to talk about.
The score is really good. I feel like it is deserving of a much better movie. It's a modest score. Like, there's not a whole lot of it in the film. There are maybe two or three main musical motifs that are used multiple times throughout the movie, but they're good. And they're deserving of a more thoughtful set of images to accompany the sounds.
Yeah, my only critique on the score is that I wish there was more of it, because there are plenty of scenes where there's no Brian Eno. Yeah. And then also I wish it was louder, because it's so subtle that it also actually, at least in my viewing, and who knows, you know, stereo settings and so forth, I felt like the score wasn't loud enough. The score could have been a little louder.
I agree. And that a lot of the scenes with music were just using the same music over and over. But did you notice the script had a similar quality? There's a very copy-paste quality to Land of the Minotaur, where characters would have whole scenes where they were only saying lines that they had already said in earlier scenes.
Yeah, this is not a film where anybody gets any good lines. Nobody. Whether you're the star, top billed Donald Pleasance, whether you're the evil cult leader, Peter Cushing, even if you're one of the various other smaller players in the picture, you don't really get any cool lines. Nobody has anything really cool to say in this movie. Most people don't really have anything cool to do in this movie.
Rob, I'm going to have to disagree with you about the lines, because you are forgetting the part where the character Milo says, "Where the devil did the whole village get to?" And Donald Pleasance answers him, "You've answered your own question. To the devil." Yes.
Yeah, I guess we should hit on an important fact concerning this movie at this point, is that it is essentially a satanic cult movie of the 1970s, except instead of it being outright Satan, there's like some slapdash Minotaur cult stuff added in instead. But they don't even really commit to that. Like, they don't even go all in on some sort of like ancient religion or mythology of Crete or some sort of imagined Minotaur religion. Like, at one point, Donald Pleasance is like, it's Satan, Minotaur. It's all the same. It's all the same stuff.
Same thing. There's a whole speech about it. It's like the force with 1,000 faces and no face at all. It's been around since before humankind. Some have called it Mephistopheles, the devil, the Minotaur. It's all the same.
So just one of the many ways in which this film, you know, is competent and has a lot of talented people in it and people doing a very professional job, but it doesn't go for it in any of the ways that you might expect one of these other films to do, both in a positive way and a negative way. Like, it doesn't even really go for any of the really exploitive stuff you might expect. I mean, the worst we get is like maybe a little bit of blood, and then it looks pretty good. We get some, some basic 70s sexism, but that's about it. It's not really an exploitation film at all.
No, there are scenes where characters just stand around and take phone calls naked for no reason.
Yes, yeah, and they are very naked in those scenes. And I guess the actors involved can be commended for that. But that's about the extent.
Now, I think, as is often the case with lackluster films, a lot of the blame here goes to the script. It's just like not the most engaging story of all time. But on the other side, like, what is working pretty well here, it does have a pretty good cast, though most of them are not giving, I think, the best performances of their careers. It does have that nice Brian Eno score, and we'll talk more about that as we go on. It also has some really good locations, like a lot of the outdoor shots and the stuff in the caves and all that. I'm like, oh, wow, okay. So, like, they got permits, I guess, to shoot in some very pleasant and interesting-looking scenery.
Yes, solid cave locations, some very gorgeous scenes of the Greek countryside. And also, I thought they have a pretty nice, like, cult lair set that they built. Some sort of, like, you know, sort of gothic dungeon cult kind of a set that looks pretty good.
Now, may we compare and contrast with the other Cult of Human Sacrifice movies that we've featured on the show? And I guess in order to do that, we need to remember what all of those are. There is, of course, The Devil Rides Out from 1968. That is the one that is based on the novel by Dennis Wheatley. Is that his name?
Correct, yeah. And I think one of the things about The Devil Rides Out, because it's based on that Wheatley novel, is that it aspires to a sort of, and we discussed this in our Weird House on this, it aspires to a sort of almost documentary feel. Like, Wheatley and or this movie is trying to warn you about the real threat of the occult, and this movie is just making it all up. I mean, they're both,
yes, but but in The Devil Rides Out, there are more interesting dynamics about good and evil and all that. In this one, it's just kind of like the moral of the story is that, well, there is a devil and the devil's real, and you got to defeat him.
Oh yeah, there are all sorts of interesting rules that are employed in The Devil Rides Out. Like, magic has rules and laws to it. Yeah. And there are all these different examples that Wheatley clearly took out of like old witchcraft grimoires and so forth. And again, you just don't have that in this movie.
Oh, there's another interesting thing in The Devil Rides Out about how some people have the power, have the fortitude to explore the occult without being seduced and destroyed by it, and others don't. If they start learning about the occult, it's just going to suck them in, and they will be overpowered. Like Christopher Lee, he can read all the occult tomes, but Simon, you'd better not read them.
Yes. Well, there is one classification of human that is safe in this movie. As we find out, it is, of course, the children.
So the children here can read the occult tomes unharmed, but if you're Peter Cushing and you read them, you will not only end up leading a Minotaur cult, you will literally explode at the end of the film.
Yes.
That brings me to the second point of comparison. Another movie we have talked about on Weird House is The Devil's Reign from 1975, which is only 1 year before this movie came out. I can't help but notice that comparison and the similarity with the titles. So this is The Devil's Men, also known as Land of the Minotaur. I don't remember which titles for what region, but somewhere it was called The Devil's Men. That was The Devil's Reign. Both are about a cult doing human sacrifice in a rocky, arid landscape. And so I wonder if The Devil's Men was trying to use a similar title and a somewhat similar ending to kind of steal some of that melt juice from the Ernest Borgnine hit.
Probably so, yeah, because the Devil's Men is the U.S. release title, which came after the Minotaur or Minotaur release in the U.K.
Is that it? I thought it was the other way around. I thought it was The Devil's Men in the UK and Land of the Minotaur in the US.
Hmm.
You could be right.
Now you have me flipped. I'm lost in the labyrinth now. It's one of the two.
Now, those are the two main satanic cult movies we've covered that I can think of. Others, Treasure of the Four Crowns had a cult. I don't know if that was satanic. It was instead based around that guy. What was his name? Like Johnny the cult leader. He had a name.
I don't even remember the name of that guy. I can picture him, though. This is an interesting dynamic to point out because I think The Devil Rides Out and The Devil's Reign are both a lot more entertaining compared to The Devil's Men.
Yeah.
And I think those are ultimately perhaps better movies. This is all subjective. I would say Treasure of the Four Crowns is definitely a worse movie than The Devil's Men, but it is more fun to watch because it is so stupid. And The Devil's Men, it's like on one hand, it's not, you know, it kind of falls into that sort of lukewarm category in some ways because it's not bad enough or stupid enough, or it doesn't have wonky enough performances to really make it fall into that, cheesy movie territory. But it doesn't, again, just doesn't really go for it in so many other areas.
It doesn't have the wall-to-wall madcap 3D effects of Treasure of the Four Crowns.
Oh, yeah. Imagine if this had 3D. Would have worked in a few scenes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I wonder if I can know which ones you're thinking of. 3D nostrils blasting fire in your face.
Oh, yeah.
Now, beyond that, did the Blind Dead movie we did have a cult? I don't remember if that had a blood cult or not.
The Templars are depicted as a blood cult in that. And, of course, the whole setup is they were a blood cult, then they're all dead. And then, like, the lone troublesome occultist in town helps them return from the dead. We talked about Return of the Blind Dead, so I can't really speak to Tomb of the Blind Dead, the first one, because I haven't seen it forever. But, similar stuff going on, but I think even more key is that while this movie is filmed in Greece, it still has a similar feel compared to the Blind Dead movies, you know, dry, dusty walls and ruins used as a backdrop for some sort of an occult story.
Now, there's one thing I think some of the better satanic cult movies do that most of the movies we've talked about don't really do. I guess The Devil Rides Out sort of did, is show the advantages one gets from worshiping the devil. So that's, you know, classically there in like Rosemary's Baby. It's like, you know, you make a pact with the devil. Oh, hey, suddenly I'm financially doing better and I'm getting a part in this play and all that. You know, the devil is in exchange for your worship and the evil deeds you do in his service. He sort of does favors for you. He does some magic to help you along with to attain your goals. A lot of these movies don't even have that, so you're kind of left wondering, like, what's in it for the cultists? Why are they worshiping a minotaur or a devil? I don't even see that they're getting anything out of this.
Yeah, I mean, I guess sometimes it's in the performance. Like, Borgnine looks like he's having a good time.
That's true.
And, of course, in that one, to be fair, there is the whole plot line that's established that they have been alive for over 100 years because, or maybe centuries, I don't recall, but they have vastly extended their lives because of their pact with the devil. In this, I guess we sort of assume wealth has something to do with it, but otherwise we don't see any real results.
I don't know. A lot of these cultists don't seem all that wealthy. Like Peter Cushing's character is wealthy, but most of them are like, oh, the town, the innkeeper and the guy who works in the grocery store, they're in the cult. What are they doing all that hot?
I guess it's a pyramid scheme, you know, that's all it is.
Got in the cult too late. They're trying to get some more recruits into their downline.
Mm-hmm.
can you imagine the pyramid scheme pitch, but it's in the Minotaur voice from the movie, like the statue's talking, saying, bring me 3 to 5 of your Facebook friends.
Yeah, I can very, very well imagine that. In the accompanying booklet for the Blu-ray that we'll mention here in a minute, Andrew Graves mentions some other influences. He mentions The Devil Rides Out. He mentions The Devils. Also mentions The Wicker Man from 73, which I thought is another great comparison, because The Wicker Man, of course, is like the English folk horror film, you know, par excellence. You know, it's the one that you think of when you think of like the lineage of British folk horror. And this movie kind of aspires to a kind of Greek folk horror, but again, doesn't really go for it, you know, doesn't really give us something that we can latch onto here.
Well, yeah, again, because it has so little interaction with any actual Greek mythology or any of the particulars or the feel of the Minotaur itself. As we said, it's just sort of like, oh, the Minotaur, that's just another kind of devil. That's, you know, there's a devil and one of his forms is it's a bullhead horns and there's not much else to it.
Yeah. So, a lot of missed opportunities here with this film, but there's still some fun stuff to talk about here. My elevator pitch, I don't have a great one here, but I just went with Ambient 666, music for satanic Minotaur cults.
Yeah, music for blood gutters.
Yeah. The actual tagline, or one of the taglines for the film, I thought was extremely deceptive. Half man, half beast, trapped in a world forgotten by time.
Huh?
Sounds great. Not this movie, but it sounds great.
I feel like it would be equally appropriate if that were the tagline for Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Yeah. All right, let's go ahead and listen to the trailer audio. It is a pretty fun trailer. I don't actually recommend watching the trailer if you intend to see the film in full, because it does that thing where they take whatever action they can find in this movie and they cobble all of it together into this trailer. Like, you see stuff from the finale in there as well. But still, it's a fun one. So let's have a listen.
Come with us, if you dare, on a terrifying journey through cells of madness, haunts of horror and fear. Come with us to this forsaken monument of crumbling stones which echoes the desolate cries of the damned. Descend with us to the forbidden chambers of the ancient pagan gods of wrath, where the devil's men perform the secret rites of the land of the Minotaur. Those who enter the forbidden chamber of the Minotaur must die. The land of the Minotaur. Donald Pleasance, as the man of God, who defies the dark and sinister powers that curse this land and all who venture into it.
The devil has many faces. And many help us, too.
Come on, let's get out of here.
Peter Cushing as the Red Prince of Evil, who lures young lovers into the deadly embrace of the devil's men.
The old customs remain, and the ancient gods live on.
The old customs remain, and the ancient gods live on.
Cannot stop them. No earthly power can stop them. The Land of the Minotaur, the most terrifying film of 1977, coming to this theater soon. Don't miss it.
All right, I want to take issue with this trailer's claim that this is, quote, the most terrifying film of 1977. Note that it was released in the UK and Greece in 76 and then in the US in 77. Because if this statement were true at all, it would mean that The Devil's Men is more terrifying than such films as Alucarda, Blue Sunshine, The Deep, Demon Seed, Eraserhead, House, The Incredible Melting Man, The Island of Dr. Moreau, Cronenberg's Rabid, Rituals, Rolling Thunder, The Sentinel, Mario Bava's Shock, Shockwaves, Sorcerer, and Suspiria.
Wow.
So granted, it's, you know, pure marketing. Everything's fair in marketing. If no one else is going to say you have the most terrifying film of 77, you might as well say it. But I don't think a strong case can be made for The Devil's Men over these films.
Now, when it comes to ways of watching The Devil's Men or Land of the Minotaur, this is actually a movie I became aware of a while back. It might have been when we did our core episodes on the Minotaur myth. Mm. I'm not sure. It was sometime in the past few years I found out about this, and the streaming version I found of it online at the time I wanted to watch, but the quality was like so bad it looked unwatchable. But there's actually a very nice Blu-ray or DVD, whichever it is that we watched of it. I guess it was a Blu-ray, and it looked really good.
Yeah, this is a terrific Blu-ray release from Indicator. I don't think they put out a lot of copies of this. It's one of these like limited to however many thousand in the U.S. But it, you know, reasonably priced, includes a new 2K restoration from the original negative, two different cuts of the film, lots of other extras. So, you know, whatever faults you might have with the movie itself, like this is a great presentation of it and has some great background. There's some commentary tracks. So I highly recommend it if you are inclined to view the movie. We're going to pass our copy of it onto Videodrome here in Atlanta after we're done with it, so you might be able to rent it from them if you happen to be local. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astaproallergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
L-A-S-I-K, LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
L-A-S-I-K, LASIK.com.
All right, let's get into the people involved in this movie. And I'm going to go ahead and apologize at the top here. We're dealing with some Greek names here, and it's entirely possible, if not likely, that I'm going to mispronounce something. The director is Kostas Karagiannis, who lived 1932 through 1993. A very established Greek director of various genres, but this was his first and only horror film. He'd done some thrillers, it looks like, but In some of the commentary I've read, a lot of people touch on this, that this is the only time he dipped his toes in horror, and perhaps it shows in his, you know, unwillingness, or I don't know, just inability. I don't know how you want to look at it, but the fact that it doesn't really go after those horror moments the way that other horror films would have. So you know, while he draws on various satanic cult horror films, the horror, the terror, the suspense elements in this film often feel a little bit blunted. We get some great ambiance in places, and certainly with the aid of Eno's score, we get a strong dreamlike flavor to various scenes. But I feel like these scenes are often lacking, again, in that special something to push them over the top and make them actually memorable.
Yeah, I agree. For one thing, I think we have something of a problem that, like, the main monster in this film is actually just a statue, and it's not that scary looking of a statue. It's sort of more on the funny looking side. So that's the main monster. And then we've got some cult members who wear, you know, anytime you put somebody in creepy cult robes with hoods, that looks creepy. But they're still not really used much. I mean, there are like some scenes where they like peek in a window to scare somebody, but then they like pull their head back out of the window when the person sees them, and it just looks funny.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, because there are shots where the cult members are scary and you see those eyes behind the mask and all, but yeah, other times not so much. Sometimes they're bulletproof, and that's never explained either.
Donald Pleasance makes reference to that almost as if it's like a known thing about cult members. He's like, they can't be destroyed by, at one point, I think he says, the force of an automobile is not enough to destroy them, because they hit a cult member with the car, but he's fine.
I guess this is the benefit. This is the fringe benefit for worshiping the Minotaur. Now, Karagiannis here, his other big films for the Greek market included 1973's Tango of Perversion, 1974's Death Kiss, and 1977's Dangerous Cargo. Again, this was partially a Greek production, but you had outside money coming in. Interestingly enough, I think some Getty money was involved in funding this particular picture.
Huh?
They were involved in film production for a while there.
Huh.
All right, the writer here is Arthur Rowe, who lived 1923 through 1998, an American writer with TV writing credits going back into the early 1950s. Eventually including episodes of such shows as Kolchak the Night Stalker, The Bionic Woman, and Fantasy Island. Those last two, he was also a producer on those. He wrote three other screenplays that made it to to film. Those include 1971's Zeppelin, 1972's The Magnificent Seven Ride. I assume that is a sequel. It sounds like it's an actual ride, though, but it, you know, like you would...
The ride at Universal Studios.
Yeah, but it's a movie. I don't know anything about it. Also a 1976 Kolchak TV movie, Demon and the Mummy.
Was there supernatural stuff in Kolchak?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was a fun show back in the day. I mean, I didn't watch it back in the day, but I watched it at some point, like on Sci-Fi Channel in the 90s.
Oh, okay. I've never seen it. I assumed it was a earthy, realistic cop thriller.
Darren McGavin, I believe, played the lead in that. All right, let's get on into the cast of this film, though. Top billing goes to Donald Pleasance, who plays Father Roche in this. Lived 1919 through 1995. This is our first Donald Pleasance film. Famous British actor of stage, screen, and TV. He was reportedly offered the villain role for this picture, but said nope, he would only do it if he got to play the hero, as he was a bit... burnout on playing the villains at the time. Because, of course, he's a member of the Bond Villain Club, having played the Bond villain, Blofeld, in 1967's You Only Live Twice.
It's Blofeld, Rob. I know you're not a Bond fan, but yeah, it's Blofeld.
Not Blofeld?
Blofeld.
Ah, Blofeld sounds like more of an actual name. I don't know.
Blofeld in...
Like
so
Springfield.
Exactly. He has a secret volcano lair in You Only Live Twice. And You Only Live Twice is the one where Blofeld feeds his victims to piranhas. So he has like a bridge leading to his office. And when you're walking over the bridge, if he's unhappy with you, he presses a button, the bridge collapses, and you fall into the piranha pit.
I remember enjoying this one as a child, watching it on Turner channels and stuff. I think there's an airplane that folds into a suitcase.
Yes.
There are ninjas. And then there's a lot of racial stuff that probably hasn't aged well.
Yeah, there is a really unfortunate whole sequence where they attempt to turn James Bond Japanese. And it's weird. But the villain stuff in it is pretty good.
Now, I think you can see the impact of that role on subsequent Donald Pleasance villain roles, you know, that sort of detached, gray-eyed mastermind sort of performance, which, again, Pleasance is a solid professional, so it's solid stuff, even in some really lackluster films. But the thing about Pleasance is he did a lot more than just those villain roles. We see in this film a kind of hint of what was to come with his Dr. Loomis performance in the Halloween franchise. He had a memorable role in The Great Escape from 1963, which was itself quite fitting because Donald Pleasance served in the RAF during World War II, was captured and imprisoned in a German prisoner of war camp.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So he has a pretty interesting filmography. But just considering horror and sci-fi, his credits include a 1956 TV adaptation of 1984, 1960s The Flesh and the Fiends with Peter Cushing, Circus of Horrors and The Hands of Orlok in 1960, 1966's Fantastic Voyage, THX 1138 in 1971, Tales That Witnessed Madness in 73, From Beyond the Grave and Mutations in 74, an adaptation of Dracula in 79, The Puma Man in 1980.
Puma Man.
Puma Man is a great example of him being asked to do the Bond villain thing in a movie that is clearly not the best.
I'm trying to remember whether the villain role I'm thinking of him in is the one from Puma Man or the one from Warrior of the Lost World.
That's right, because that's another one where he does the same thing, is asked to do the same. That's 83. Sandwiched in between these two, you've got Escape from New York in 81. That's a rather different role for him.
He plays the President of the United States of America.
I remember reading about him talking about that role where he's like, yeah, Carpenter asked me to play this role, and so I had to work out why a British person would become President of the United States, and it had all this background material. And then he like asked if Carpenter wanted to read it, and Carpenter's like, no, I'm good. But I like that commitment, the professionalism, you know?
Yeah, the part when he's getting into the egg-shaped escape pod from Air Force One, and he says, like, may God be with you all.
It's a pretty good performance in Escape from New York. You know, he, especially later on in the film where he's a little, it's more of a raw performance, you know?
Yeah.
Other films, let's see, 82's Alone in the Dark, Phenomena in 1985. This is the Dario Argento film, right?
That's right. With him and Jennifer Connelly, and one of the craziest giallo plots of all time.
Let's see, To Kill a Stranger in 86, Warrior Queen in 87, Spectres and Prince of Darkness in 87, and in 1988, he's in that Nosferatu in Venice movie. This is the one where Klaus Kinski was asked to reprise his role as Nosferatu, asked to shave his head and report to set, and he was like, I'm not shaving my head this time. And obviously, there were a lot of problems with that movie. But not Pleasance. You can count on Pleasance. He's a rock.
You know, if we ever wanted to do a John Carpenter movie, I feel like we could do Prince of Darkness.
Yeah, I think that one would be a good selection. Let's put a pin in that one and consider coming back to it. Great cast, weird film. Yeah. Now, real quick, a few other things on Pleasance. I'm not going to touch on everything he was in, because again, all sorts of different genres. But I will say he has a very fun and very spirited role as a blue-collar police inspector in 1972's Death Line. That's one of those terrific performances that completely elevates a film, and also is very much against type, at least for what many of us might expect of Donald Pleasance. If you're a Pleasance fan, check that one out. It's a lot of fun. I've also heard great things about his performance in the 1971 Australian New Wave thriller, Wake and Fright from 71. A lot of people hold that up as kind of an excellent buried gem.
Oh, never heard of it.
Yeah.
Another thing, did you mention that he appears not only in the first Halloween movie, but in many Halloween sequels, including sequels after he was killed in the previous film?
Oh, no. I'm not as familiar with the various Halloween sequels past two, I think.
Okay, so you remember at the end of Halloween 2, he's definitely dead, right? Just explodes, huge ball of fire. He's dead.
Yeah.
Part 3, No Donald Pleasance, totally different story. We know
I kind of forget that it's part of the Halloween franchise because it's, obviously I'm familiar with three.
Right. Four, he's just back. He's back. just some, I think some scars on his face. And then I don't remember what happens to him at the end of four, but he's back again in five.
Oh, wow. Also, just real quick, I'll note that he also did a lot of TV. He was on the original Twilight Zone, the original Outer Limits, and then much later at the Ray Bradbury Theater. Pretty good. Pretty good. I believe four of his daughters went into acting as well, with the most notable being Angela Pleasance, who did quite well for herself on stage, screen, and TV. She's been in a load of things.
One last thing you didn't mention. Donald Pleasance was the spirit of Dark and Lonely Water.
Yes, of course. This was like a public service TV bit, right, that was warning children to stay away from the dark and lonely water. Stay away from those green pools, lest a dark fate fall upon you.
I think we talked about this in our episodes on Ginny Greenteeth, but yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Stuff to Blow Your Mind episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, narrated by Donald Pleasance.
All right. Again, Peter Cushing is in this, playing Baron Corifax. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about Cushing here in this part because we've covered Cushing before. He lived 1913 through 1994. Kind of a weird house cinema standard at this point. I think the first time we discussed him was in our episode on Shockwaves, which came out the same year as this. This is, what can you say? This is Hammer's Dr. Frankenstein. This is Star Wars' Grand Moff Tarkin. So he's always solid, whether he's playing a villain or a hero. Though this is, as Graves points out in the material on the Blu-ray, later day Cushing, during which he's generally more memorable in smaller, more intense roles rather than bigger villain roles or, more pronounced roles like this.
I want to say he seemed especially angular in this film. Like, Cushing always has a striking face with very sharp features. But in this movie, it's just ridiculous. His head, I was trying to think what it reminded me of, and I realized he looks like a boss from the original Star Fox video game, where it's just polygons, the angles, the corners. It's crazy.
Yeah, I can see the comparison. It's a very stark face. I mean, when he was a much younger man, he still had a very stark face. And here he's, he's leaner, he's older. I think at this point he'd been through some intense personal loss. His wife of many years had died earlier in the 70s. And I think that kind of cast a shadow on him personally for a good decade there, if not the rest of his life. But again, consummate professional. Very talented, even in a role like this that isn't really asking him to go beyond anywhere. Even though he doesn't really do anything all that memorable, it's still nice when he's on screen. All right, who else is in this thing? Okay, we have Luann Peters playing Laurie. Luann Peters lived 1946 through 2017, also sometimes known as Carol Keyes, beautiful blonde English actress and singer. She started out on TV in the late 60s, but eventually became a Hammer horror star after appearing in 1971's Lust for a Vampire and Twins of Evil, which had Peter Cushing in it.
Peter Cushing plays a kind of witch finder, inquisitor sort of character in that.
Hmm.
He's the very stern, church-like uncle of the titular Twins of Evil.
Ah. Are the twins themselves evil, or are they just of evil?
Only one of them is evil. One becomes the sort of vampire bride of Count Karnstein. Is that what he is? He's the guy in the movie. So there's like an evil count in the movie who is a Satan worshiper. He has dinner parties where he like lifts his goblet and says, "To Satan." And he seduces one of the two twins, and she becomes evil, but the other one is good.
Oh, okay. All right. Luann Peters' other horror credits include The Flesh and Blood Show from 72, Vampira from 1974, but I have to stress, not the seemingly lost German TV movie Vampira, directed by George Morse, starring Grisha Huber, and with an early score by Tangerine Dream. I'd love to get my hands on this. If you have a copy of this, email us. But no, Peters was in the Vampira movie that is also known as Old Dracula.
I don't know that one.
It's not supposed to be very good. Her TV credits include two episodes of Doctor Who and a memorable gag on Fawlty Towers. I included a screenshot from this for you here, Joe, as well as one of her album covers. So, yeah, she was quite a fairly successful back in the day.
Love Countdown is the Lou Ann Peters album.
Yeah. She's wearing like gold pants.
Gold pants, yellow top, blonde hair, sort of gold background with gold lettering. Yeah.
All right. We also have a character named Milo that's going to be important, played by Kostas Karageorgis, who lived 1938 through 1989. So his character in this is an American playboy who spends the first couple of scenes naked in New York. not on the streets, like in a, like a penthouse apartment. But the actor is a Greek leading man.
He looks like he's in a room at the Playboy Mansion. But in all of his scenes in his room, there is like church organ music playing in the background. Did you notice that?
I didn't notice that.
What's going on?
Yeah. So this may be his best known international film, but his other works include 1962's Sky, 1973's Love on a Horse, and 1977's Dangerous Cargo, which we referenced earlier. He's kind of a young, prematurely gray or white-haired fella. And I think he's good in this. This is a hard film to gauge anyone's talent on.
Yeah, I don't think the actor is bad. I think it's a very poorly written part. His character is very flat. Like, he just has basically one type of line, which is, I'm a detective. I need facts. Stop with your daydreaming.
Yeah, he's like a private detective that I'm really floored by what the actual connections between any given character is to another. Like, we have this basic idea that Donald Pleasance, this kind of Catholic priest, has like this longstanding relationship with these young folk that have gone out all over the world. But I don't know what that was. Like, was he a teacher? Did he raise them? I just don't know.
They don't make it seem like that. So yeah, but it's very perplexing. He's Father Roche. Father Roche is an Irish priest living in Greece who constantly has American archaeology students coming to live at his house while they do archaeology.
Yeah, and his main defining characteristics are, he, you know, likes the young people, he's hip with the young people, loves God, of course, yeah. Hates Minotaur cults.
Hates the devil. He's really not into the devil. But yeah, also, like you said, it would be one thing if he was like, oh yeah, I run a hostel for traveling students or something, but it's not like that. It's like he knows all of these students from long before. He's like, oh, I remember you when you were just a child. So yeah. Where does he know him from?
Was there another movie we were supposed to have watched or something? I don't know.
You know, I think they're trying to set up a sequel to this movie at the very end.
They did do that at the end, yeah, where they're like, well, the evil is defeated for today, but...
He turns to Milo and he's like, I may need your help in films yet to come.
Yeah. If the Getty money continues to pour in, we may have another adventure.
But also, so those are our three main characters. When we've got Father Roche, Milo, and Laurie, that they're the three main cast starting at like a third of the way in. But also, this movie has too many characters.
Yeah, there are a whole bunch of other characters who really don't do much other than like behave in a sexist manner and then get kidnapped by Minotaur cults. So we have Bob Belling playing Tom. Belling lived, I believe, 1944 through 1977. These dates are not listed on the major databases, but I was poking around. I think they're correct, but they could be incorrect. American actor and model who worked extensively in Greece for a while, appearing in at least five films. But I'm to understand he also did some modeling work. Three of his films were all released in 76. This, a kind of Greek giallo film called The Hook, and a notorious video nasty titled Island of Death, about a pair of British newlyweds who seem like they're just on a honeymoon, enjoying life, but then they go on a religious, murderous rampage through rural Greece. It's kind of universally reviled and was seemingly his final film before his possible untimely death. Again, I'm not 100% sure on these dates, but that seems to be the story.
I noticed in this movie, when I was first watching it, I saw an actor. I was like, wait a minute, Brad Dourif's in this? It wasn't Brad Dourif, but at certain angles, this actor looks a lot like Brad Dourif, except more with a kind of football player physique.
Yeah, I think he has a great look, you know, like clearly he's He's a, like a cut leading man type with this kind of like rugged 70s hair and face. Again, he doesn't really get to do much in this. And once he's kidnapped by the Minotaur cult, like, that's it. Yeah. You're tied up for the remainder of scenes.
I guess you wouldn't think that Brad Dourif could so easily, with a few tweaks, go into like total hunk mode. But yeah, he's pretty close already. Sorry, we just got sidetracked with a significant off-mic conversation about which guy was which. Whether Tom was which character and Ian was which character. But I think all the stuff you just said, we are talking about the same guy.
Yeah, there are, the secondary young people are easily confused in this film. All right, we also have an actor named Jane Lyle, who plays Milo's girlfriend. Dates unknown, British model. I think she plays the wife in Island of the Dead opposite Belling. These are her only film credits, though there is also sometimes a third credit, 1978's Erotic Nightmare. Is she a great actor? Probably not. But to be fair, she's given very little to do in this film other than be naked in that penthouse in New York. One last person of note is that this film also features Jessica Dublin playing Miss Zagros. She lived 1918 through 2012. Another American actor who was working in Europe at the time. Her credits go all the way back to 1969, but then with a lot of early work in Euro cinema, she appeared in The Hook, Death Has Blue Eyes, The Devil's Men, of course. She's also in Island of Death, all in 76. But then she eventually moves back to the States and appears in the 1988 horror movie The Rejuvenator, and also several trauma films, including Troma's War in 88, and Toxic Avenger 2 and 3 in 89.
Haven't seen those, and please don't tell me we're going to start doing trauma films.
I off the top of my head, I don't know that I've ever watched one in its entirety. I remember seeing parts of them on TV back in the 90s, but yeah. So listener recommendations, let's have them.
They embrace the cheese, and I feel like they're the kind of film that on paper would be something that we should enjoy, but I just don't like them.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
All right, well, let's talk about the music. What do you want to talk about first? Do you want to talk about Eno, or do you want to talk about the theme song that we get at the credits?
Oh, man, how about that rockin' theme song?
Yes. It's titled The Devil's Men, with music by Carl Jenkins, who I think, unless I'm confused here, I believe is a Welsh composer, born 1944. Lyrics by Carol Ann Barrett. And then the singer is Paul Williams, though not that Paul Williams, a different Paul. This is the English blues and rock singer, Paul Williams, who is in the band Zoot Money and Juicy Lucy. Juicy Lucy apparently also featured future Whitesnake guitarist Mick Moody.
Juicy Lucy's album titles sound like Spinal Tap albums. One of them is pretty much called Smell the Glove. I'm not familiar with this band much, but this track was rocking. It felt like, it had a little bit of I was trying to think what reminded me of Black Sabbath about it. And I think maybe it was the drums. It had some kind of more interesting kind of jazzy drum fills like Bill Ward does on some Black Sabbath songs. But it also had this driving kind of up-tempo beat and some really good synth. And the singer on it sounds like the guy from Jethro Tull.
Yeah. I can see that comparison. It's kind of catchy. I kind of like it.
Devil's man.
But of course, the main attraction here is this terrific score by Brian Eno, born 1948. Eno is, of course, the legendary British musician, composer, record producer, and visual artist. I'm tempted to say perhaps best known for his ambient work, but I mean, it's really too limiting to say that because his work encompasses pop, rock, funk, electronica, all sorts of stuff.
I was just trying to remember when I first became aware of who Brian Eno was. And I think I discovered him through his collaborations with David Bowie. So I think like when I was in high school, I first heard some of those three Berlin albums. I heard like Low, and I was like, oh, wow, what is all this really spooky, haunting synthesizer? And I found out Brian Eno had been a collaborator on these albums and was partially responsible for the sound and direction of them. But yeah, God, where do you start with Eno? That's my personal story.
Yeah. I mean, he played synth and Roxy music from 70 through 73. He's still active today, still producing, still writing, still building up that legacy. Now, I guess it's in a way it's easier to just sort of like hone in on his work with film over the years. Because when it comes to film, his tracks and tracks that he's produced have been featured on various soundtracks. His track, An Ending, Ascent, from the 1983 album Apollo, Atmospheres and Soundtracks, has popped up in more films and TV shows than I can list. Absolutely amazing ambient track. He's also had composed isolated tracks for films over the years, including the Prophecy theme from David Lynch's Dune in 84 and From the Beginning from Dario Argento's Opera from 87. He's also composed a number of tracks for non-existent films, and I'm not deep enough on the background of these tracks to know which ones were in fact tracks he composed for films that don't exist, that are kind of like in the spirit of score composition, and I think some of them were also like originally intended for film projects, and they didn't come together. But you'll find these on 1978's Music for Films and 1983's Music for Films Volume 2. But as far as complete Eno scores for films, where like he's doing the sole score work, he did some scores for Derek Jarman, Peter Jackson's The Lovely Bones in 2009, and also the 2005 film The Jacket. His score for The Devil's Men, aka Land of the Minotaur, was, I believe, his first full score and for film, and only his second composition for film, following a short 1970 film titled Berlin Horse. In terms of his discography, this comes out in 76, so it's following his work with Robert Fripp on 75's Evening Star. This is an album that JJ was talking to me about and recommended that I listen to, and it indeed is awesome. This also comes out after his solo album, 74's Here Come the Warm Jets, 74's Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy, 75's Another Green World, and 1975's Discreet Music. The weird thing about this score, though, is despite the fact that it's Eno, I don't think it has ever been released. And none of the tracks are seemingly featured on his release, Film Music, 1976 through 2020. So I'm not sure if it's a rights thing or if it's a situation where Eno is not, doesn't look back on this music favorably. But I mean, to my ear, I think it sounds wonderful. And it seems like the sort of film score that film fans would jump at and also Eno completists would jump at.
I agree. And, I was thinking about this. I can't say for sure because I knew about Eno's involvement before I started watching the movie, but I feel like the music here is so distinctively Eno that I might have identified it even if I hadn't known. The first track we hear in the movie is actually very simple. It only has a few elements. There's kind of a lower droning pad, like a robot moaning softly. And then there is there's what sounds kind of like a tape loop effect, introducing little rhythmic hiccups and interruptions in the drone. Mm-hmm. And then there's a soft higher part that's basically just stepping back and forth between two notes. So it's a pretty simple track, but I think it's just unusual for a movie of this kind. And its mood imbues what you're seeing on the screen with so much more interest and emotional paradox than would be there otherwise. Like, it is at the same time calming and unnerving. It kind of feels like it's safe to settle down and go to sleep, but also it suggests a question, like, is there danger?
Yeah, I mean, really, in the opening scene, there's about to be a satanic sacrifice, but the music does kind of imbue you with that feeling of like, yeah, I'm feeling kind of chill about this. And then you kind of reflect on that and compare that feeling to what's actually happening on the screen. A dreamlike quality sets in.
So there's not a ton of it, but I think it's a very, very good score.
Yeah, so it, you know, I would like to hear it in isolation, but I don't know. Maybe Brian Eno has different thoughts on the matter, and you know, you can't argue with Eno.
All right, we're going to talk about the plot a bit.
Yeah, let's get into the plot.
As I've mentioned before, I love a film that begins by showing you its papers. The disc release here debuts with a certificate showing that The Devil's Men has been reviewed by the British Board of Film Censors and has been rated X. And I was thinking, really? Why? It doesn't seem that off the charts to me.
Yeah, like I say, this film does not really have any exploitive elements to it. I mean, there's a little bit of a full nudity, but it's even so, it's very tame compared to other like naked films of the 70s.
Yeah, I don't know. So it's rated X, but who are we to question, right? X, so saith the Right Honorable the Lord Harlech KCMG, President of the British Board of Film Censors. And so I briefly got interested. I was like, wait a minute, well, his name's on this movie. Who is the Right Honorable the Lord Harlech KCMG? If my Googling has not led me astray, this is William David Ormsby Gore, the 5th Baron Harlech, who lived 1918 to 1985, who was a member of the UK House of Lords and a diplomat, including he was ambassador to the United States during the Kennedy administration, and he was an associate of the Kennedy family. Apparently, he proposed marriage to Jackie Kennedy in 1968, but she turned him down, and somehow that led to this. So he, years later, was overseeing the review and classification of fine films like this one.
So he's like, oh, what's this one here? Minotaurs, rated X. No Minotaurs on my watch.
I don't know if he actually watched the films. He may have just been president of the organization. I like to think he watched every film personally. Anyway, the movie proper opens with a deep blue night sky, a full moon, and dark tree branches looming in the foreground. And there is ambient music. There are owls hooting and insects chirping in the dark. And then we see figures walking through the night around a Greek city on a hill. Or maybe not a city, more like a Greek village on a hill. There are men in multicolored robes and hoods, like inquisitors, marching between the houses and climbing up the rocks to a secret cavern.
Yeah, like we said earlier, these various shots of like the Greek countryside and Greek cities and so forth, Greek ruins, they look good. I mean, it's attractive looking. I mean, even the some of the footage I looked at from Island of Death, like nothing else you can say, like, this looks like a cool place to visit.
Agreed. I like the rocky crags.
Mm-hmm.
And here's where we get that Eno track I was describing a minute ago. But your classic cult sacrifice scene starts to unfold. There is an ancient stone temple with columns and archways and menacing statues of bullheads and double-bladed axes. And then somebody cranks a wheel and a giant statue of a minotaur emerges from beneath the floor. And this isn't just any minotaur statue. This one has full blowtorch nose, jets of flame blasting out of each of his nostrils.
That's right. It's a magical technological marvel. I think it also has genitalia, which I think was also pointed out on the IMDb parental notes for this film.
That's what got it an X rating, the full frontal minotaur statue nudity.
Yeah, minotaur penis, rated X.
You know, one thing about the minotaur statue on its nose, Rachel and I were watching this, and she pointed out that she could see the texture of the paper mache on the nose. They're like, that's, you can see sort of strips of cloth and paper.
That's a good note. I was noticing the texture, but I didn't like instantly identify what it was. But I was thinking about the fact that I guess most of the people that originally saw this film would not have seen that texture. You know, there's so much that's lost in the prior projection of these films.
I guess I imagine this primarily playing on television, but I don't know. Maybe not.
Not with that X rating.
Oh, that's a good point. Okay, so acolytes in red and green satin robes, they light fires in a semicircular trench on the floor. It's surrounding not an altar, but three stone reclining chairs. Okay.
All right.
Some cultists bring in a man and a woman who are dressed not like the rest of the cult. They're wearing just 70s street clothes. And looks like we got some victims. So they're placed on the stone recliners. Peter Cushing appears, and he is the head cult member. He stands in the middle of the room in a red robe with a big gold minotaur chain around his neck. And he says, "We cover our faces in sight of our Lord." And then everybody in the cult repeats his words, and they all pull masks down over their faces. And the minotaur statue is just snorting so much fire.
Yeah. Again, Minotaur statue looks good. Strong atmospheric opening, I feel like. I love the set. I like the multicolored robes that seemingly hint at different ranks in the cult. So this is not just a black robes in the darkness kind of a cult. You know, they put a little color into it. I looking back at these sequences, though, they are revealing that all the villagers are members of the cult. I don't think I necessarily got that the first way through, but there's not like the, it kind of takes the punch out of the any revelation that, oh, all the villagers are in the cult. I'm like, no, you know that from the get-go.
Yeah, they're all pretty much there. And then, you know what? Not just the adults, the kids too, because there is a young girl in a cult robe. She comes up to the two people in street clothes on the stone recliners, and she stabs them in the heart with a knife. And I think I saw a comment somewhere online asking, is that the director's daughter in that role? And I have no idea, but I want to believe that.
Well, either way, she's super creepy. I love it.
So the human sacrifice is done. The people are dead. I guess that was for the Minotaur. Did he like it?
There's no way to know. It doesn't, again, there's nothing you can even compare to in the, like, the classic, more or less canonical Minotaur myth. Like, what does this do for relations between, between ancient Crete and the rest of the ancient world? Like, there's none of that. Like, nobody's being thrown into a labyrinth. We have nothing to go on here.
Oh, but there's a hilarious choice here.
Oh, yes. The opening titles, the letters for the opening title blast out of the freeze frame Minotaur's nostrils. Just an absolutely excellent choice.
Right. So it snorts out or I don't know if snorts the right word. That implies the air is going in. It sneezes out the letters that form the devil's men and then freeze frame on the fire. It's like, duh, and so there were some legitimate chortles at that moment on our couch, but because it sounds like the kind of idea like a 7-year-old would have, you know, and then the words come out of the monster's nose holes.
Yeah.
So that's good. And you might think this is the part, since there's a freeze frame, that you cut to the up-tempo rock theme, but no, not at all. Instead, we transition to a different ambient track, another big spooky mood. I guess it's Eno again. And this one is actually very spare with a lot of space in it. And the main motif is made of dissonant swelling synth chords that sounded to me like a choir of ancient mummies sighing on the other side of a wall.
Yeah, it immediately pulls you back in, and you're like, "Oh no, Eno's being real serious here." So I'm gonna be serious too.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
But okay, on to more action. Now we're in the daytime, children running through the streets, kicking a soccer ball.
Yeah, yeah. I see these kids come running through the streets, though, in a dusty European town, and I immediately assume they're going to start pelting the local hunchback with rocks or cabbages or something. That probably says more about my viewing habits than anything.
Yep. So there's a local police inspector. He's receiving a phone call. It's from a man named Father Roche, and that's Donald Pleasance, again, playing an Irish priest living in Greece. Father Roach is like, hey, how come so many people keep disappearing in your village? He mailed this cop a letter and a photo of two students who had been there and went missing recently. And what do you know? It's the two people from those stone recliners that we saw being sacrificed to a minotaur. But he doesn't know that. So the police inspector says to him, you can't expect me to keep track of every person who goes missing in my jurisdiction. And Father Roche suggests that they may have been victims of murder, and the police inspector gets real mad and says, why don't you stick to your job and I'll stick to mine? And I disagree. I think they should trade jobs.
I want to point out, and this is something I didn't get at first, but the police inspector is clearly one of the cultists. Like, yes. This actor was clearly one of the cultists, pulling a hood over his face for the sacrifice. So there's no... suspicion or mystery here. Like, he's clearly in with the cult.
Everybody's in the cult. Everybody. So we see Father Roche in his humble office, and he's pondering a gold trinket on his desk, which is a little bull head. And then we see him going about his business. So he walks on the hillside and he talks to the locals. We see him kneeling alone in a tiny rustic chapel and praying. And then we see him writing a letter. By the way, there are a lot of letters, handwritten letters in this movie. Mm-hmm. He's writing it to Milo Kea in New York. And then we fade to New York, just like come up on the New York skyline.
Yeah, so far this movie set itself up, again, kind of like a folk horror movie, but no, it's more of a globetrotter, apparently.
I guess so. When we first meet Milo, he is lying naked on a bed with pink sheets and pillows, smoking a cigarette. His chest hair is catching a shaft of sunlight. Milo creates the impression of a kind of shaggy cad. He's got puffy gray hair, though he's a young guy. He's one of those young guys with gray hair, dark eyebrows, and a very... sarcastic, almost mean kind of edge. He's hanging out with his lady friend in this bedroom that's just crammed with candles and liquor bottles and stuff. But again, this is the room where there's church organ music playing.
Yeah, and when we check in with him again in New York, it seems to be the same room, the same setting, still naked. So it implies that whatever his job is supposed to be, the only thing he does in New York is sex.
Pretty much, yeah. So he's hanging out here. He gets the letter from Father Roche. Like, his lady friend is like, oh, there's mail for you. And so he opens it up and he's reading it. She sees him reading the letter and is jealous when she sees him reading. She's like, who is she? And she takes the letter and then she reads it and she's like, oh, it's just that unwell Irish priest that you are constantly exchanging letters with. And Milo is like, okay, maybe he's gone a little too far with some of his minotaur theories, but lay off him. This is a direct quote. He's the best friend I ever had.
Oh, no additional detail on that, really, no. But he seems sincere.
How do they know each other?
I don't know.
Well, she says these things he keeps writing you about, students disappearing, being swallowed up by some ancient magic or something, it's crazy. It's medieval. And Milo says, yeah, I don't really believe him, but, you know, he's a good guy. Even though Father Roche is a good guy and he's asking Milo to come out to Greece to help him investigate the missing students, he will not do it. He's going to stay here in New York and mostly just stay in bed and, in fact, never even put his clothes on or leave the house.
Right. Yeah. Very little to suggest he wears clothes in America at all.
I think he's supposed to be a private detective.
I guess that makes as much sense as anything. Sure.
So there's more globetrotting. A group of three archaeology students show up at Father Roche's house to stay there while they're doing some kind of field work.
Oh, this is where they drive up in the Australia van, right? Super confusing van that says Australia on the front. And at this point in the film, I was like, are we in Australia? Like, I don't know. We were just in New York. Like, maybe this is truly an international picture going on here. But I think the idea is that this is like the hippie fun bus that has perhaps driven to Australia. I don't know.
I think it has the names of other countries on different parts of the van as well. Mm-hmm. I think it just says Australia on the front. But okay, we got the three archaeology students here. We got Tom. I think maybe I'm getting the names mixed up. I was going to say Tom is the one with the dark hair and the beard who looks like a member of Stillwater. But if you're correct, you're saying that was actually Ian.
Yeah, Ian is played by Nikos Verlikis, who is an actor and I think a director as well. Like he's still around and had a pretty big career. But yeah, just a very handsome, like, Greek Jesus or Hercules type of a figure here.
Okay, that you're saying that's Ian. So that would make Tom the one who looks like football Brad Dourif.
Yes.
Okay, and then you've got Beth, who has long hair, big radiant smile, very short shorts. We were joking, Rachel and I were noticing that, like, there's a scene where she's standing next to one of these guys who's wearing such huge jeans that they're basically JNCOs, and there's, like, enough material in his pants to make a whole second pair of pants for her.
Yeah.
But so anyway, Father Roche takes them inside. He's going to feed him some food. And here, oh boy, we get a table setting scan. We love to examine movie set food more closely than it was meant to withstand. So Father Roche cooks his three guests a big skillet of food of some kind. And it looked to me like the skillet had whole unchopped, basically raw tomatoes in it, and then some kind of steaming white substance. And at one point, Ian gets served out of the pan and it looked like Donald Pleasance reaches in with the spoon and like serves some food. But what comes out is just one huge floppy lasagna sheet onto his plate and not much else.
Well, you know, it's served with love though. So you don't question it, but it could just as easily have been a meal served up by a harsh witch in another movie. It would have been just as fitting.
Yeah. This is Baba Yaga. It says, eat it. So the main point of their meeting here is that Father Roche tries to talk them out of going to the village where they're headed. They want to go do archaeology, but he's like, no, students keep disappearing there. So he thinks he's talked them out of it. Everybody goes to bed. And then the students, of course, they sneak out and they go to the village anyway. They go to the village of death and camp there in tents. They know no fear.
Yeah. We know how this is going to turn out for them, though. There's no question.
And then meanwhile, we see Father Roche almost, it's like he's playing with minis or something. He's got a parchment map and all these shapes and lines on it, and he's arranging the Minotaur trinkets on it.
Yeah, I guess they are kind of like minis. This would have really been more Peter Cushing's thing, who was famously a miniature soldier enthusiast and painted them and so forth. A man after my own heart.
So while they're camping, either Tom or Ian, whichever one it is, writes a letter to somebody named Lori, another blonde woman, telling her this is going to be the third similar looking blonde woman of the movie, telling her about his quest for knowledge of the past and asking her to come join them in Greece. And the next morning he gives the letter to Beth, asking her to mail it when she goes into town to buy groceries.
You know, in this film, we will later find out that the only thing that really works against the cultists is God stuff. So yes. It is kind of weird in retrospect that he's reaching out to all of these archaeologists and non-church people when really he should have just brought in one or two other priests and they could have knocked this cult out in an afternoon.
But he doesn't even know it's a cult yet. He doesn't know. He's just looking to find the secrets of ancient Greece.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wait, are you talking about Father Roche bringing people in?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was confused. I thought you were talking about either Ian or Tom, the guy riding.
No. They're just pawns in this whole scheme. But
right.
But yeah, I think Father Roche should have brought in like one or two other priests, and he could have handled everything in just like an hour or two.
I apologize. I was confused. Yes, exactly right. He should have known better. He even says it later when Milo. So he's the guy who summons Milo. Milo just wants to shoot a gun at everything, and he's like, you fool. That will not work.
Cultists are bulletproof.
But Beth goes into town to buy groceries. And then, by the way, while the three of them are hanging out, there's a creepy guy with binoculars up on the cliffs above watching them. And we get the Brian Eno mummy size going. And so we know something is really wrong here. And the guy watching them, he's some sort of chauffeur. He's in a uniform driving a fancy black car.
Yes. And this, we'll find out, is Peter Cushing's driver.
So while Beth goes into town, Tom and Ian explore the ruins of an ancient temple, and while wandering around among the weathered stones and the columns, they find a secret doorway covered with the double axe symbol, and then they open it up. Passageway leads down into a cave full of stalactites and stalagmites, interesting rock formations. It actually is a beautiful cave. And so they're wandering around the caverns, and they find a couple of dead bodies wrapped in a red cloth. And what do you know? It's the two people from Father Roche's photograph. And then we get a Minotaur jump scare. There's a Minotaur statue just right there at him, fire nose blasting. And it says, "Those who enter the forbidden chamber of the Minotaur must die." Camera zooms in on Tom and Ian's faces. They appear to be taking this news rather stoically. They just kind of like, okay. And then it fades out.
Yeah, kind of perplexed.
I mean, I guess that would be just confusing.
Yeah. In this bright, bright cave, with just so brightly lit.
It is quite, you're right. I didn't even think about that. Yeah.
But it's a beautiful cave. So it's like you want to show everything. It's kind of like the reverse. If your cave set is barely cutting it, you're going to turn those lights way down. But when it's this beautiful actual cave environment, yeah, light it up.
So we see Beth shopping in town. She gets a kind of icy reception from this lady she meets. There's like a lady with red hair pushing a baby carriage, and the lady buys some meat and then puts it in the carriage with the baby. And Beth is like, "Cute baby." And the woman just gives her dagger eyes. And then outside the market, Beth meets Peter Cushing. And he is a very polite, courteous, genteel man. He's wearing a wool jacket and a nice suit. And Beth drops a bag of what looks like cheese puffs or something in the street. And he picks it up for her and then has his chauffeur help her with her groceries.
Doesn't she call it like, "Oh, my product," or something like that?
Yes, yeah. I think she says, "My package."
My package, yes.
My package, but it's a bag of cheese balls.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess if you're in the... In the presence of Peter Cushing, you know, you may scramble your words. And afterwards, she's like, "Oh, why did I call my cheese puffs my package? Oh, my God." So embarrassed.
Well, she explains that she's an archaeology student. She's here to do archaeology. And he says, "Well, I am Baron Corifax. This castle is my castle, and you're on my land." And it's like, oops, oh, I guess we didn't clear that with him ahead of time. But he says, "Don't worry, if you're genuinely interested, this is one of the oldest pagan sites in the country." Her answer to this is, "Are you a real baron?" He says, "It's an ancient title in his own land, which is Carpathia, but now he lives here." And I got so tripped up here, we had to pause it and try to figure out, is he saying hereditary titles and lands are transferable from Carpathia to Greece? Like, can you trade in your Carpathian barony for a Greek castle?
Well, European royal families, it's complicated, right?
Yes. yes, you see, it is because I am my own cousin. Well, anyway, so he's friendly. He offers to help her and her friends, and then she drives away. She asks for her package, and he gives her the cheese doodles, and then she drives away. And then the mummy starts sighing in the Eno score, and he gives a devilish look. So we know, oh, he's up to no good. And when she gets back to her campsite, Tom and Ian are nowhere to be found, and the tents are gone. So she goes to look for them at the temple ruins. We see her later that night walking outside the Baron's estate, and then dudes in cult white robes just kind of wander up to her and she screams.
Yeah, I mean, she's generally worried there because, like, Tom and Ian don't seem to know how food works. And they're out there alone without cheese doodles. And it's just gone from bad to worse here.
They do genuinely seem like they're like, oh, no, we need Beth to cook for us and otherwise we will starve.
Yeah.
So we transition to a plane landing and let's get a good look at that plane. Oh, it's on the runway now. OK, now it's turning around. Did you see the engines? Here are the jet engines.
Yeah, get some good globetrotting stock footage.
And we meet another blonde lady. This is Lori, who either Tom or Ian wrote the letter to. And she goes to stay at Father Roche's house. She's like, hey, what happened to my boyfriend? Why didn't he meet me at the airport? And Father Roche is like, I have had enough of students disappearing. We've got to put a stop to this. So he finally commits to doing the charges of a long distance call to call Milo at his house on the phone and demand he come to Greece to investigate. And then, like, the very next moment, Milo's there in Greece.
Yeah. It's like, Milo, I need you to put pants on. I need you to find your passport. And he does.
Milo doesn't own pants, so I'm sure he has to send out for some. So then we get the three of them driving in a car on a country road, and Milo is driving fast and recklessly, and Donald Pleasance is like, I'd have taken the bus if I'd known you were such a speed demon. And this is a dynamic. I said earlier that this is a movie where the same conversations just happen over and over again. Mm-hmm. And this is definitely one of those things. There are four different scenes where they are driving a car and he's driving too fast and they talk about how he's driving too fast.
Yeah, because we come back to this later where he's like, where they're just talking about the same thing again. More driving, more moving from point A to point B.
Another conversation that repeats many times is Milo saying, I'm just a simple private detective. I deal in facts, not demons and devils. And of course, Father Roche is like, well, you know, you'll learn soon enough. So they're driving around. I guess they're trying to start their investigation and they stumble across a funeral where there is a sudden weird psychic mind meld between Lori and the local girl. Wait a minute. Was that the girl wielding the knife in the cave earlier?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Another nice scene of this girl staring, blank expression at the camera. I think Eno music kicking in, making it nice and creepy and dreamlike. I like it.
So they stay at the local inn. And then later this night, there is a scene that's really funny where Lori is like in the bath. And then the cult members, I guess, are trying to come get her. They're like, one's coming in the door and another one's coming in the window. And she sees them. And then when they see that she sees them, they like run away. So they like retract their heads through the doors and the windows and like slam them shut. And we see this happen about 17 times. So Laurie's like, hey, there were guys in weird hoods trying to get me in the bath. And Milo doesn't believe her. He's like, oh, yeah, you were just dreaming or something.
He deals in facts.
That's right.
Facts only.
But yeah, nothing she says is even supernatural or anything. She's just like, guys attacked me while I was in the bathroom. It's like, that is a perfectly factual seeming statement.
Yeah.
So the next day they explore the temple ruins, they find the passageway, they go down into the caverns, they find the sacrifice room. There is a chandelier trap where Milo saves Donald Pleasance and Lori from a falling chandelier. Mm-hmm. And I think Milo goes up to like the rope that has frayed and says, oh, is this an act of God? And then Donald Pleasance says, there's someone here. I can feel him all around me.
Yeah, this is a great set, and the chandelier trap is one of the few action sequences in the whole picture. So of course it's in that trailer, but I do love the set.
Let's see. So skipping over a few things here, Roche and Milo. Oh, there's one point where they go and speak to the Baron at his house. He like sends a car for them, and not a lot comes out of this scene. The Baron is. We learn that he's an exile from his home country, and they kind of trade some pleasantries. And then we see the lady with the baby from the grocery store, and she says she is staying with Baron Corifax. And we see the baby playing with this gold artifact, and Donald Pleasant says it's an odd toy. And Cushing says it is old, but not odd. It is the Labyrus. And Donald Pleasant says, I know. It is the ancient symbol of the Minoan priesthood. And then later he explains to Milo when they're alone after they've left the house. He says, I didn't want to say too much, but it's also a symbol of human sacrifice. And then Milo is like, shut up. It was just a toy. I only want facts. By the way, remember that Milo said Donald Pleasance is the best friend he's ever had.
You know, and again, Milo is supposed to be a detective, but the detective work in this film is pretty shoddy. Never felt like we really have a detective story. It's the investigation portion of the film is just feels kind of sloppy and with lacking in direction.
So they come back to the inn that night. And by the way, there's a recurring theme with like this woman from the village who wants to talk to them. But every time she wants to talk to them, one of the like the police inspector will pop up from behind a bush and kind of grunt at her menacingly. And then she'll act scared and run away. So that happens a few times. And then they find her dead at the inn.
Yeah, I think this is Jessica Dublin, by the way.
Okay. Mrs. Zagros.
Yeah.
All right. And then also this night we see Laurie getting chased through the woods by people in cult robes, like they're chasing her. And then Milo goes and he hears her screaming. So he goes and finds her in the woods. And she's like, there were men chasing me. And Milo's like, nah, nonsense. Probably just a cow got loose in the woods.
Jeez. Yeah. The film is there again. It doesn't get into like really big sexism. But there's just like a pervasive film of sexism over the entire thing, you know? Like, again, doesn't really get into exploitation territory, but it's like nobody listens to the female characters at all.
All of the young men, at least, do not listen to any of the women. Yeah.
Yes.
I guess Donald Pleasance is sort of, he's listening.
He's listening to everybody. He's hip. He's hip with the young folk.
That's right.
He's hearing them out.
So when the three of them get reunited, they learn, oh, the whole village is deserted because Roche had been going out trying to find somebody to help them. I think maybe because they heard Laurie screaming, but he can't find anybody. So all deserted. There's no power. The houses are dark and empty. So they go up to their rooms at the inn with candles, but then Milo goes back down to the bar because he says he's going to have a drink, I guess, in the dark. And Laurie is scared. She says there were people in the woods, like some human fiend. And here Donald Pleasance is listening to her. He's like, I know. And this is where he gives his speech about the devil. The force acting here is older than mankind, the power without a face. It may have been known as Mephistopheles or Beelzebub or whatever else, but it is all the same. It is the devil.
Yeah, again, it's just devils, minotaurs, all the same thing. Doesn't matter. I'm opposed to it. Let's go stop it.
So he goes back downstairs. So there's a lot of just kind of going up and downstairs here. he goes back down to Milo, and this is where they have the exchange about where the devil did the whole village get to. And he's like, you said it yourself, the devil. Mm. But then it finally reveals where the three archaeology students from 30 minutes ago were. They are in a cave, still alive, being held prisoner by Peter Cushing, and he stands in front of them without saying anything. But the Minotaur talks to them. The statue says, only one thing can save you now. Or I guess it does a creepy voice. Only one thing can save you now. Father Roche must die. He has entered my forbidden chamber. And she has I think he's sort of talking mostly to Beth, and Beth has a vision of herself stabbing Donald Pleasance with a knife. And she's like, oh no, you know, it wants me to kill Father Roche. And she says she won't do it, but Cushing and his chauffeur are both standing there and they laugh like, ha ha, ha ha, ha ha, ha, and they just wander away.
Yeah. It's like a creepy sequence, but nothing's really done with it. Like nothing really evolves out of this moment.
There are actually a lot of scenes in this movie where nothing changes plot-wise. Yeah. Nothing new has happened.
Mm-hmm. But you keep watching because you know there's going to be a showdown. You know that there's going to be some sort of payoff at the end.
Right. So we start getting there. So Roche and Milo They see more cult figures moving around, or I guess maybe Milo sees them for the first time, and then they chase after them. They chase the cult members, then the cult members chase them, and there's a lot of chasing around. They get the two non-cult members get locked into some kind of walled garden, and mm-hmm. we see a ceremony beginning where Cushing is saying, "The old customs remain, and the ancient gods live on," which isn't much of a catechism, I don't know. But everybody repeats this. They're saying all the same things he's saying. And then we see the archaeology students. They're tied to poles like prisoners of the Ewoks and brought in, put on the recliners. And Ian and Beth get deposited on stone recliners, and the girl stabs them in the heart. Or maybe it's Tom and Beth, whichever, Ian or Tom. So they're dead. And later, Donald Pleasance and Milo just walk up on these recliners and find them there. I don't know how mm-hmm. they got to where this was. But so they're driving around, and at some point they hit a cultist with their car, and then they uncover his face. And I think it's the police inspector. Is that who thought it was?
I think it is. Yes.
And he smiles. He's like, "Ha ha!" And he gets up and he runs away. And Roche says, "Yes, he was at the edge of death, but it takes more than the force of an automobile to destroy them." And I was thinking, where did he get this info? He's like Van Helsing, but instead of knowledge on vampires, he has knowledge on Minotaur cult members.
Yeah, and they're sort of bland powers. Bland but impressive. Like, yes, you can survive a gunshot, but it feels like the kind of thing that would have been impressive in like an action adventure serial from the 30s, you know. That's like the level of threat and magic we're dealing with these cult members.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com, one place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK. LASIK.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
So the next day in the village, everybody is going about their business. But now Roche and Milo are walking amongst these people in the streets, and they realize all of these people are members of the Minotaur cult by night.
Finally putting one and two together here. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Who would have thought? Also, they realize, whoops, Lori has been cult-napped in the night. So now she's been taken by them. And they know she's probably going to be sacrificed the next night. So they're trying to figure out what's going on, and Milo is like, "Wow, finally he recognizes something is up when Lori is gone." So he starts. The police inspector comes in the door of their room at the inn, I guess, and is like, "Hey, what's up?" And Milo just starts beating him up and punching him in the face, throwing him down the stairs, until he is stopped by Peter Cushing, who is like, "Hey, why are you beating up a police inspector?" And then Cushing pulls a shotgun on him. So it's Baron with a shotgun here. And what's the deal with it? He says he's going to give them 1 minute to do something, maybe to get out of the inn or something. And then he counts down a few seconds, but then shoots the clock. It's a really kind of a squib of a scene.
Yeah. So many squibs in this movie where, yeah, there's not really any kind of payoff. It's unclear exactly like why we were here. But you keep watching because you know you're going to get to that big showdown. There's going to be a showdown. There's got to be a showdown.
Oh, we're basically there. So Roche and Milo drive away. Milo pulls a gun out of the glove box in the car, and Donald Pleasance is like, haven't you learned anything? Do you really think you can stop this with bullets? There's only one force that can fight them. And so Donald Pleasance and Milo stop at a roadside chapel to get weapons. So they get a crucifix and holy water and all this for the final showdown.
I did like that we got to see the sourcing of the holy water. I feel like this is one thing the film does well. More often than not, you see the holy water in a vampire movie or what have you. It's, you know, it's already been collected. It's just in a little bottle, as if you get it that way and you store it that way. But I kind of like that we saw the collection of the holy water. It's one of the few moments in the film where they successfully build towards something else.
I agree. I like this scene also. Also, we see Peter Cushing go to the temple to speak to the Minotaur, and the Minotaur, unsurprisingly, wants him to kill the priest. He's like, bring me Father Roche. I don't know why he's so interested in Father Roche. I think it's because he entered his forbidden chamber and is still alive, but that's also true of Milo and of Lori, who I guess the cult has now in custody.
You know, time was a Minotaur would take care of this problem itself. You know, that yes. was kind of the classic situation.
Yeah, yeah. But now he's got to get Peter Cushing to do his work for him. I don't know.
Yeah.
So there's a final showdown. Milo and Roche go back to stop. You know, there's a ceremony going on. You can imagine exactly what it is. There are no real surprises at all at the end of this movie. There's a big ceremony, and they've got Laurie there, and then they've got whichever one of the archaeology students it was that's still alive, either Tom or Ian. Those two are still alive, and they're going to be sacrificed. You know, the girl with the knife is there. Ceremony's going on. Milo busts into the ceremony with a gun, but the cultists basically don't care. They just sort of ignore him while he's like blam-blamming at them. And they just grab him, you know, because they're invulnerable to bullets, of course. Only a greater power can stop them. So they tie him up to the third recliner at the front of the temple. And I guess they're going to sacrifice him too. The Minotaur statue once again reiterates those who enter the forbidden chamber of the Minotaur must die. And then Roche he comes in and he defeats them all. How does he do it? Is there like a big twist? What is it he's going to do? He holds up a crucifix and he says some Latin. He's like, in nomine Patris, and then the Minotaur and all of the cult members explode, like just shrapnel everywhere.
The least little bit of religion down here, the least little bit of Christianity down in the Minotaur's lair just explodes everyone except for the cultist children. So anybody in, I think the children are all wearing what, white robes.
Yeah.
So if you have any other color of robe, you just completely explode.
Green, the purple, the red, they're all exploded.
Yeah, just completely blasted. You know, it's kind of like a low rent version of the Devil's Reign. Instead of having them like slowly, painstakingly melting for, you know, a good 15 minutes or what have you, it's just a few quick explosions and they're done.
But I think this is kind of funny because the creepy cult girl was the one who actually physically did all the murders. Like she put the knife in the people, but she's okay.
She's an innocent Joe.
That's right. So she and the other kids, they wander out and, you know, Milo's like, how come they didn't explode? And Father Roche explains, he says, they are young. Their souls are incorruptible. But the fight against evil goes on. One day, Milo, I may need your help again. They are setting up a sequel. And then it cuts straight to the rock track. You know, let's get a sample of that, JJ.
So groovy. What kind of globe-trotting adventures are these two going to get into in the next film that they didn't make?
Maybe they'll go back to Roche's home of Ireland and there'll be a banshee and we'll learn about how banshee is just the same thing as the devil.
Yeah. Like, I think that would be the template. Satanic cult that's worshiping the banshee. And then they do a film where they go to somewhere in the U.S. and it's like a satanic cult that's worshiping Bigfoot. Just whatever. Just
which quickly is also the devil.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, in all cases, it's obviously the devil. And then they go to one, it's like, it's a satanic cult and they're worshiping, oh, Jesus, oh, this is just a church. Then they're like, okay, cancel this. This is just another church.
Okay, well, I think this is definitely not one of the best films we have covered, but you know what? I had a great time on today's episode.
Yeah, this is a fun one. I also want to drive those explosions. When the cult members explode, it's not gory. It's just kind of, they kind of explode. It's like they're like driftwood.
They're like pinatas.
Yeah. So yeah, this is a fun one. It's hard to recommend this one to folks unless you are a completist on any of the talents involved here. I think if you're a big Brian Eno fan, it's worth checking out. Again, if you're a huge Donald Pleasance or Peter Cushing fan and you just must see everything, then give it a go.
I think this is a good movie to put on while you're doing something else. That's something I like to do sometimes, where if I'm like hanging out with people, I put on a silly movie on low volume that's not too visually arresting. This is a good one.
Yeah, I think in fact I have a neighbor who had this years and years ago. I think he was playing this in his backyard. It's pretty good to play in such a setting. And, you know, the Greek connection is pretty cool. I like getting to check Greek cinema off to some degree on the Weird House Cinema International checklist.
This was the one.
Well, we're not doing Island of Death, that's for sure. But we always, we invite recommendations from listeners. So if there is another example of weird Greek cinema that we should consider, write in and let us know.
Yes, of course.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and close this one up. Just a reminder that Stuff to Blow Your Mind is primarily a science podcast with core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. But on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns to just talk about a weird film here on Weird House Cinema. If you want to see a list of all the movies we've covered over the years, you can go to a couple of places. We have a profile on letterboxd.com. That's letterboxd.com. We're Weird House there. There's a list where you can see all the films we've covered over the years. And I also blog about these movies at samutamusic.com.
Huge thanks to our excellent audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.